You're listening to All the Best. I'm Maddie McQueen. We're taking a break over the next few weeks, so we're going to play you some of our favourite stories over the summertime. We'll be back with brand new episodes in February.
I'm Erin, and I'm a supervising producer for All the Best. This story is by Jared Richards, and it's about his fascination with testing toothbrushes in his sharehouse. I love this story because, frankly, it's pretty gross, but more than anything, I love the sound design by Pip Leeson and the punchline at the end. This one's called Mouthfeel.
When I first used my housemate's toothbrush, it was an accident. See, I'd been struggling to wake all year, thanks to a combination of buzzing mosquitoes and a few relentless thoughts that lingered more than the February heat. None can be blown away by a $20 Kmart fan, so I'm usually still half asleep when getting ready for work, as I was a few months ago, staring at myself in the mirror, toothpaste coagulating around my mouth, dripping down the brush handle and into the sink. It was the latest of my many messes. Upstairs, half-drinking mugs of tea colonized every surface in my bedroom, from bedside table to bookshelf. Not the floor, though. That belonged to my clothes, shared by the many months of New Yorkers still in their plastic wrap. I would clean it all when I needed to, not necessarily when my clothes ran out or ants feasted on festering crumbs. The toothpaste scud slid down my hand and onto my arm. I considered if this small morning ritual of brushing my teeth could be the first step towards greater cleanliness. Physical, yes, but also ontological. I was concentrating on how I could feel myself change, tooth by tooth. It was only when I went to rinse that I realized the brush, which resembled mine to the touch, was not hot pink, but purple. Quelle horreur! Once I realized what I had done, my mind raced to examine the implications. Ethical, socio-political, dental. Maybe nothing, right? Housemates share things. A house, for starters, but also snacks, Netflix accounts, electricity bills. We even already shared toothpaste, something I, as the only person to buy toothpaste, had accepted long ago. Is it really crossing a line to share a toothbrush? But I couldn't pretend. I knew a line had been crossed. It was different. Our bodies had now been probed by the same stick. But whose body? I had no idea, and it was of utmost importance to find out. Could it be A or H? If needed, I could tell those two about the mishap at any moment, in text, in passing, during an ad break. I wouldn't need to sit them down or apologize. We would laugh it off, seeing it as a one-time mistake. But G. G enjoyed space, privacy, cleanliness. But did he enjoy the colour purple? To be safe, I decided to never mention it. To leave no trace, I rinsed the brush with care, dried it with a hand towel, trying to remember which way the head faced when I picked it up from its holder next to the sink. All day, I found myself preparing for a potential confrontation. Would G instantly suspect me? Would he make a scene or plot a quiet vendetta? How would he know? Taste? Smell? Perhaps I'd brushed the bristles too hard, their new shape speaking of someone else's mouth. I found myself treading lightly that night, staying in my room and resisting the need for water or food. When I heard G turn off his light, I headed to the bathroom. Grabbing my own toothbrush and squeezing the tube, I stared at my well-worn bristles, flattened out from the center by applying too much pressure, like twisted roots of a pot plant searching without aim for fertile ground. I had no idea how long I'd had it, 2 years, three, and just like that, I could no longer ignore what it was telling me. Like eating toast for dinner or not washing my sheets, it was a sign that I, no matter how much I pretended, did not really care about myself. But the purple toothbrush was pristine. Its owner must brush lightly, not motivated by a need to scrub away the day. It must be G's, who treated his body to morning stretches and home-cooked meals every night. I washed the toothpaste off the pink brush and put some on purple. I let the bristles caress my teeth slowly, imagining G counting 4 seconds for each tooth like he'd been taught as a child. Gradually, I felt the plaque break up like it does in the commercials, dissolving away to nothing. That night, I slept sound. I woke before my alarm for the first time in years. With time to spare, I did a load of washing, and before leaving for work, I took a chance with the purple brush again. I even used the tongue scraper, those little weird bumps on the back of brushes, and felt even better. I kept pushing further and further back until I gagged and spat up a glob of phlegm. It glowed green like cartoon toxic waste, leached from my body. That day, I spoke without the scratch in the back of my throat during meetings at work. My voice was soft and reasoned, like G's. I used his brush over the next week, morning and night. Each time I scraped my tongue, I imagined my taste buds resetting, my words now able to travel past without picking up old flavors. But with each brush, the bristles tasted more of myself, sickly metallic and familiar. It was clear I needed to let the purple brush recharge, to let G's spit settle. On the seventh day, I decided to try the green toothbrush. I sucked the bristles to see if I could detect a certain je ne sais quoi, and then applied the toothpaste. That day, I picked up the litter in my room and cancelled my New Yorker subscription. I even went for a jog. It wasn't too long, however, till my clarity clouded. As the power of the green toothbrush waned, I was confronted with a conundrum. By process of elimination, the two yet untouched brushes were H and her boyfriend's. Unfortunately, they were indiscernible to the taste, and I gained no reward from them. I began to panic. I decided to rotate between green and purple. I was resigning myself to red or black every third day to allow the others to regenerate. On bad days, I'd brush my teeth up to 5 times, which meant taking them to work and returning them before their owners could notice. I knew it was risky. I was being careless, but I didn't care. Not only was I destroying the delicate harmony of our share house, but I was destroying the brushes themselves. With each day, I felt less and less. Nothing could recreate the thrill and the danger of that first brush. Late one night, unable to sleep, I scoured the bathroom for alternatives. Soap, razors, shampoo. Nothing catches the essence of another person quite the same way. In the morning, after a shower, I noticed some underwear my housemate had forgotten to pick up on the bathroom floor. But they were too tight, and after a day of constant wedgies at work, it felt only the itch of disappointment. Then, 2 months into my journey, G messaged our group chat.
Hey, does anyone know where my toothbrush is gone? It's the purple one.
H replies.
Wait, which brush?
Then A says,
the purple one?
G.
Yeah, that's my brush.
A. No, that's mine.
H.
What are you talking about?
Turns out the four of us had been using the same brush for months. Recently, I've returned to my own pink toothbrush, which has lost its metallic mouthfeel. Sometimes I still switch it up. Now I'm staying overnight regularly at a boy's house. The first morning that I found myself in his bathroom, he offered me his electric toothbrush while he trimmed his beard. The vibration tickled my gums, and when I was done, he grabbed it from me. I stood with no reason to be there, with nothing to do but watch. He brushed his teeth with a childlike fury, the foam sliding out of his mouth and dropping down his arms. As he leant down to rinse, he paused to look at me in the mirror, standing behind him. He laughed and said, "This might be weird, but I think I can taste you."
You're listening to All the Best. I'm Maddie McQueen. All the Best is about training emerging Australian storytellers in the art of audio. If you'd like to be a part of the show, you can start by pitching to us at allthebestradio.com. We'll pair you with one of our supervising producers to help make your story. This week, I'm choosing a story. So I've chosen A Bird in Hand is Worth Two in the Grave by Patrick Lenton and Suzanne Derry. Patrick and Suzanne have done two stories together. The other one was about a swimming pool. And in both of the stories, they just mesh so well together. Patrick's an incredible writer, and he has this really dark humour that goes along so well with Suzanne's quite comedic music and sound design. I think they just really get each other, and I really like listening to it. I hope you do too.
I've long had both a suspicion and a theory that adulthood isn't something that you realise is happening to you. Instead, it sneaks up and surprises you like some sort of responsibility ninja. One day, you're without a care in the world, planning your next expedition to the all-night discotheque with your school chums, and then suddenly, bam, you're covered in mortgages. Swoosh! Your superannuation is spiking dramatically, and swish, children are coming out of your no-no zones. Clearly, none of this has actually happened to me yet. My responsibility ninja has been particularly slow and inefficient, allowing me to wander the world in a kind of lazy, privileged daze, brunching with reckless abandon for far too long. A while ago, my ex-partner and I were living in a house on the outskirts of Sydney in a quaint little suburb called Earlwood, populated by a lot of Greek nanas and water features teeming with mosquito larvae. There's not a lot about our house that's very remarkable at all, except that I'm pretty sure in its dusty corridors I was thwacked resoundingly with the baton of adultness. And because it was such a long time coming, I was hit hard and brutally. With so much gore and gratuitous violence, I'm fairly certain I've been propelled directly into the has tins of biscuits phase of life, that from now on I'll be forever confused and baffled by boy bands. I was working my first full-time job, coming to terms with the novelty of getting up at a specific time each morning, going to a workplace where other adults took my opinions seriously, and then coming home exhausted and dispirited, looking into the future and seeing only a repeat of the same day until I die. But I was being paid too, which seemed like a good trade-off. I was dealing with a chronic health issue which meant I couldn't eat anything more exciting than boiled rice, and I had to quit coffee and alcohol and cheese and other things that make life worth living. My ex-partner and I had also adopted a new rescue puppy who we named Ernest. I cannot stress how terrifying and life-changing it is to suddenly be responsible for a small life. Everything changed with Ernest. All our routines and freedoms and hobbies and pleasures became second place to our tiny prancing dog child. We became people who'd go out with our friends and then about an hour later, look at each other meaningfully across the table and make a subtle gesture to indicate that we should get back to our puppy baby. And yes, I'm aware that some parents are getting riled up at the continual comparisons I'm making between my dog and your human babies. I'm not an idiot. I know there are substantial differences. But I'm going to keep referring to my dogs like they are my children because the responsibility is analogous, even if the scale is slightly skewed. I'm also going to do it because privately I believe dogs are better than babies. Anyway, these momentous changes in our lives all occurred in the Earlwood house, which was the kind of place where parents live. I sometimes wondered if this was it for the rest of my life. Suburbia, work, cleaning up dog vomit. Whatever happened to my cool hypothetical life of parties and excitement and adventure, which I'd never actually had because my favourite activity in life is reading in a dim, silent room. In many ways, I've been looking forward to being old all my life and draping myself in tweed and soup. But now that my youth seemed to be passing me by, I suddenly wondered if I should be worried. These feelings came to a head when I was left as a single dog dad. I started getting calls at work from my real estate agent about Ernest tunneling under the fence and breaking into the next door neighbor's house, who was also our landlord. I got complaints that he was howling the entire time I was at work. I started getting up at the crack of dawn to try and get in two long walks a day, in a futile attempt to wear out his hyperactive puppiness. I was exhausted and stressed all the time, malnourished from only eating rice. One horrifying day, I realized that Ernest had eaten an old Easter egg that I'd thrown away, and because chocolate is poisonous for dogs, I tried to force salt water down his throat to make him vomit it up again. There are no words to describe the horror of looking into his panicked, trusting little puppy eyes as I held his mouth open and poured another liter of salty water into him. This is adulthood, I thought. But after about 4 weeks of solo dog dadding, things started to fall into a rhythm. One Saturday, I was washing dishes and looking out the window. Ernest was frolicking in the dappled sunlight. As I watched him absently, I thought maybe adulthood wasn't so much about increased responsibility, but about greater risk versus reward. You had to work harder for sure, but you're also rewarded with better things, like cool dogs and stable jobs and never having to go to music festivals. Sure, Ernest could be a hassle, but he also made my life so much brighter and happier, and it was weird knowing that I would, like, do anything to keep him safe, but also so rewarding and oh my god, I realized that Ernest wasn't frolicking in the morning light, he was mauling a bird. I ran outside, screaming and clapping my hands at him ineffectually, like a traumatized play school host. And just as I reached him, my baby boy tore the Indian miner's wing completely off. I picked up Ernest and held him under one arm, removing the wing from his mouth, holding him back as he struggled to have another go at the bird. To my horror, the bird didn't die? Despite the copious amounts of blood, despite the fact that I could actually see inside the bird. I don't want to be needlessly graphic right now, but this entire situation was so far beyond being alright that I just can't gloss over it. I kneeled in the grass, listening to shrill shrieks of pure bird pain, wondering what I could possibly do. I knew that there was no point in taking the bird to a vet unless vets could provide an entire wing and partial torso replacement. I just hoped that it would die quickly because it was clear that it was suffering. But for the next 5 agonizing minutes, it didn't even do that for me. It struggled on, wailing and shrieking, dragging itself around in a pathetic semicircle. Finally, I knew what I had to do. I had to put it out of its misery, like a cowboy does with a horse with a lame leg, like the networks did when they finally cancelled Big Brother. It was the brave thing to do, the adult thing to do. So I cast my eyes around and saw a hammer in our shed. The hammer was our only tool, and also a novelty gift. The back of it was a bottle opener, the inside of the haft hollowed to keep a shot of booze. But it also functioned as a hammer. So after taking a deep, horrified breath, squirming puppy under one arm, I beat a bird to death with a hammer.
You're listening to All the Best. I'm Maddie McQueen. Over the summer, we're taking a break, so we've picked some of our favourite stories to play for you over the next few weeks.
Hi, this is Ryan Pemberton, executive producer for All the Best. So the story I've chosen this week came about in kind of an unexpected way. It's produced by Chloe Gillespie, who's one of the community coordinators for the show, and one afternoon when we're working on the newsletter and the socials, I looked over at Chloe's laptop and there's a Facebook event for her friend's birthday party. Like, the cover photo on this Facebook event is a watercolor painting of her friend with her hands pressed to her temples in the universal gesture of communicating with supernatural forces. And there are all these, like, multicolored penises flying around her, and the text above her says "Dick Psychic," and I was like, what is that? And Chloe explained it to me, that her friend has or claims to have this gift, and I was like, huh, that's interesting, that feels like it could be a story. And I think what I like about that is a lot of the time contributors come to us and they want to make a story, but they feel like they don't have one. And I think it's a good reminder that, you know, we all have stories to tell, and sometimes it just takes an outside perspective to tease it out. So I hope you enjoy Dick Psychic by Chloe Gillespie.
A content warning: this story contains swears.
It's 10 p.m., women's bathroom, at a bar in inner city Sydney. I was with my friend Katie. We were taking mirror selfies, and these two other women walked into the bathroom. One of them was loudly talking about this dude that she really wanted to bone. Katie butted in and asked to see a photo of him.
And then I was like, show me the guy.
They pulled out his Facebook profile.
And I just got a strong sense from looking at the photos of him that he didn't know how to fuck, and so I had to tell her that. He looked like he wrote a lot of bad poetry in his spare time and had like floppy hair and like a jacket and just like looked like he was trying to be deep but only reads one book a year, actually.
And then she looked back at them and said,
"Don't bother. I'm a dick psychic and he's not worth it."
This wasn't the first time I'd heard Katie talk about being a dick psychic. I'd known her for about 2 years at this point and heard her mention the skill multiple times, but I'd never really taken it seriously. This was the first time I'd seen her do a reading in public, and I instantly needed to know more.
Hi, I'm Katie Cunningham, and I'm a dick psychic. The dick psychic, you might say. I've never met another one like me. Okay, well, I guess the first time I really, truly realised that I had this gift was a night a few years ago, and I was sitting around with a friend of mine and, well, I guess like a group of friends. And this one friend of mine was talking about a guy that she was kind of dating or sleeping with or whatever, and she was saying how it wasn't really going well. And then I kind of interrupted and I was like, oh, because the dick's bad. And her neck like snapped towards me and was like, how did you know that? And I was like, oh, I don't know. I just knew.
Wow.
Like, I just knew, and I just realized in that moment that I knew what everyone's dicks were, and I had always kind of known that, but I didn't realize that it was like a thing that other people didn't know as well. And so then all my other friends that I was with were like, read my boyfriend's dick, and then I read their boyfriend's dick, and they'd be like, she's right, and I just kept reading these dicks, and I kept getting them right, and it was like, well, I guess this is me. I'm a dick psychic.
Oh, I wish I hadn't laughed as you said that. I'm so sorry.
So is that when you realised that you had a special, it was a special gift?
Yeah, I mean, I think the way that I kind of explain it, to borrow a metaphor from C.S. Lewis's Grief Observed, which is a very different subject matter to what we're talking about, it's kind of like being in a room that gradually fills with light, and then eventually you just kind of look around and you're like, oh, the room is light. But there wasn't some thunderclap moment where suddenly I was like, I'm a dick psychic. Like, it just kind of, oh, so like, oh, one day I kind of looked around and I was like, yeah, I know what everyone's dick is. You know, it's kind of like it wasn't until other people reacted to it that I was like, oh, everyone doesn't just know what a dick is without seeing it? Okay.
What was the very first penis that you pictured?
There wasn't one particular dick. They'd just always been there. But I do think my powers kind of crystallized a bit more as I got older. Like when I was 21, was I out there knowing what dicks were like straight away? No. It was like kind of something I developed after years in the trenches of dating and being around men. I learned how to read their energy and work out what their dick was from them.
So it wasn't until you'd seen a dick in the flesh that you could start picturing dicks?
Oh, yeah. It wasn't until years after my first dick, really, that I think this happened.
So when you're doing a reading, do you see an image of a dick?
It's not like I see a mugshot of a dick. It's just like I just know what that person is like in bed, what their dick is like generally, just like who they are sexually. Mm-hmm. Like it's everything. I mean, I feel like I keep saying this and sounding really like spiritual, but it's like, no, I just know what it's like. Like, it's like, yeah, I could summon the image of it if I want to, but it's not necessarily an image. It's just a knowledge. It's just like this deep down knowledge.
I know you said before that you don't see sort of a picture per se, but can you see the balls?
I try and think about balls as little as possible. Generally speaking.
Does being able to read their dick give you a better understanding of them as a person?
Yes, definitely. I mean, there's that classic old quote of everything is about sex except for sex, which is about power, and I think that's very true. And, you know, I think that there's a lot of personality traits that, I don't know, it's kind of a chicken or the egg situation where those personality traits kind of make them good at sex, but also being good at sex makes them have those personality traits, if that makes sense. Like things like being confident or self-assured or comfortable in your skin, or like being able to laugh at yourself and not take yourself too seriously. Those things are all things that make someone good at sex, but also if they are good at sex, like they probably feel those things anyway. And so once you kind of like start picking up on those vibrations, it's like you do get this window into how someone is in the bedroom. And, you know, like my whole thing with dick psychic is it's not about like measuring dicks. This isn't an aesthetic thing of like purely what someone's dick looks like. It's about their whole sexual energy as a person. And I think that that just like vibrates off people.
Do you ever wish that you didn't have this gift?
Yeah, definitely. Like, you know, in True Blood when Sookie would like walk into Merlot's the bar and she could like hear all these people talking and it was like really deafening and it was driving her crazy. That's often what I feel like in a room of men. It's like, oh God, like I can't help but see your dick right now and I really don't want to.
Like Edward Cullen and Bella, has there ever been a dick you couldn't read?
Yeah, there's been a couple of dicks where I think they were attached to men who I wanted, like who I liked, and I wanted to hook up with them. But it's like I kind of knew deep down that the dick wasn't going to be good, but I didn't want to admit it. So it's like, it's kind of like, oh, I don't want to look, like I don't want to know. It's not like I couldn't read the dick. It's like I didn't want to allow myself to read the reality of that dick.
So you have the power to sort of turn it off a little.
I mean, I think when you like have a stupid crush on someone, you can just like tune out any kind of reality.
So like explain to me how you're using this ability day to day.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, historically women, like no one's really cared about whether women enjoy sex. And that's something that we're just starting to think about in like recent decades or years or whatever. And so, I don't know, like women's pleasure and women's enjoyment of sex matters and we need to like talk about that more. And, you know, you don't have to put up with a dud root, ladies. Like you deserve to get off as much, if not more, than he does. So, you know, yeah, I don't want people to have a bad time. By the way, I do dick readings for free out of the goodness of my heart, service to women and people who have sex with men everywhere.
All the Best would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands on which we make these stories and pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging. All the Best is made at FBI Radio in Sydney, in association with SYN and 3RRR in Melbourne. This episode was mixed and compiled by Alina Godwin. Our executive producer is Ryan Pemberton. Jordan Fennell is our Victorian State Coordinator. The All the Best Community Coordinators are Chloe Gillespie and Danny Stewart. Our SYN Community Coordinator is Lee Robinson. Matilda Fay is our social media producer, and I'm your host, Maddie McQueen. Shining Bird composed our theme music, and Annie Hamilton designed the artwork. We're heard across Australia on the Community Radio Network, and we're made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can find out more at cbf.org.au. You can find all of our episodes at allthebestradio.com. We're also a podcast, so subscribe. We'll be back with new episodes in February.